Hello, it is Friday, July 10th. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. South Korean chipmaker SK Hynix has raised over $26 billion in a share offering as it's set to debut in New York on Friday. More on that in today's news briefing. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we will be talking about a law that aims to crack down on fake news, but is also triggering concern about its potential to undermine freedom of speech. Plus, we look at a film that focuses on the flight of North Korean defectors and a Brazilian movie that's finally made it to Korea. All that and more on Korea 24. South Korean chipmaker SK Hynix has raised over $26 billion in its share offering as it's set to debut on the NASDAQ Global Select Market in New York on Friday. Our KBS World Radio News reporter, Pae Ju-yeon, joins us in the studio to give us the latest on the story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Ju-yeon.
Hello, Andrew.
My understanding is that this landmark NASDAQ listing marks the largest foreign debut in U.S. history.
That is correct. It is the largest foreign listing that surpasses Chinese tech giant Alibaba's $25 billion record set in 2014. It's also the second largest initial public offering ever, trailing only SpaceX. SK Hynix priced its American depository receipts at $149 per share, a U.S. regulatory filing showed Thursday, valuing the offering at approximately $26.5 billion. Driven by the AI boom and its leadership in high-bandwidth memory chips, demand for SK Hynix shares has been overwhelming, with strong interest from global long-term investment funds and technology-focused funds.
Also on Thursday, Micron Technology announced a major investment plan in a move widely viewed as a strategic check against the South Korean memory player. Can you tell us more about Micron's plan?
Micron Technology announced it will inject $3 billion to boost the U.S. semiconductor supply chain alongside its broader plan of spending over $250 billion in the country through 2035. U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, who attended the Micron event, reportedly urged SK Hynix and Samsung Electronics to expand their production presence in the U.S., emphasizing that the American supply chain takes priority.
Let's turn now to some news on government policy. The government will be announcing its real estate tax reform initiative late this month or early next month. Before finalizing the initiative, the government is planning to invite opinions from the public at a series of forums. Give us the details, please.
At a press briefing Friday, Presidential Policy Chief Kim Yong-bong announced that the Land and Finance Ministries and the Financial Services Commission will hold public forums to discuss housing supply, finance, and taxation issues. President Lee Jae-myung will then attend a public event dubbed National Grand Debate on Real Estate Policy on July 23rd to discuss the opinions shared during the previous week's forums.
These forums will come as apartments in Seoul remain out of reach for many prospective homeowners, right?
Yes, according to the Korea Real Estate Board's latest weekly survey, prices of apartments in Seoul rose 0.3%, extending an upward trend for the 73rd consecutive week. The Seoul City government said Friday that property prices in the capital city rose 2.67% from May to June, based on transaction applications, marking the highest jump since the implementation of housing market stabilization measures last October. With those measures, the government had designated all 25 districts of Seoul and 12 areas of Gyeonggi Province as land transaction permit zones, requiring mandatory prior approval for home transactions in those areas. The government is now considering the contentious option of raising real estate property taxes to tackle the rising housing prices.
Let's now get the latest on President Lee Jae-myung's state visit to Mongolia. He had a lunch on today with the Korean community in Ulaanbaatar. Tell us more about that.
At the luncheon, he said South Korea and Mongolia have laid the foundation for a new chapter in bilateral relations, highlighting the two countries' strategic partnership in areas such as critical minerals, advanced industries, energy supply chains, and digital transformation. He said exchanges between the peoples of the two countries had preceded official government cooperation, adding that Mongolia's nomadic tradition and Korea's pioneering spirit have fostered a natural sense of mutual understanding. He expressed confidence that cooperation between the two countries would continue to expand, with the Korean community playing a key role in deepening the partnership. Also on Friday, Lee laid flowers and observed a moment of silence at the grave of Korean independence activist Lee Tae-jun in Ulaanbaatar.
Now to North Korea. The Reclusive States Reconnaissance General Bureau will be expanding its functions. Before we go further into this story, could you first tell us about the agency's existing functions?
The Bureau is tasked with collecting intelligence and conducting covert operations targeting South Korea and other countries. According to the North state-run Korean Central News Agency on Friday, the North held on Thursday its first enlarged meeting of the 9th Central Military Commission of its ruling party, Workers' Party of Korea. And during that meeting, the issue of enhancing the agency's functions were discussed. The meeting chaired by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un discussed ways to multilaterally expand the function and duties of the intelligence agency to ultimately boost the agency's military reconnaissance and intelligence capabilities.
And do we know what kind of new functions this bureau will have?
No, the KCNA did not elaborate on how the Reconnaissance Bureau's functions will be enhanced. And in Seoul, the Unification Ministry said it will keep a close eye on related science, while some North Korean experts have said the agency's enhanced functions could mean the North could raise its level of provocations against South Korea.
For our final story, monsoon rains have subsided on Friday, but the nation is now set to face hot and muggy conditions from the weekend. How hot are we talking about?
According to the Korea Meteorological Administration, morning temperatures on Saturday will range from 21 to 26 degrees Celsius, similar to or slightly higher than Friday's, with Seoul expected to see 25 degrees. The first tropical nights of the year are forecast to occur in many parts of the country early Saturday, following recent occurrences in the southeastern region. Afternoon highs are expected to rise 2 to 5 degrees from Friday, reaching 29 to 36 degrees nationwide, including 33 degrees in Seoul. Heat wave conditions are expected to continue in many areas, with perceived temperatures likely to remain well above 33 degrees Celsius for the time being.
Due to a rise in heat wave alerts nationwide, the Ministry of the Interior and Safety has upgraded its heat wave crisis advisory. Is that correct?
Yes, from caution to alert, effective 3 p.m. Friday. This comes 11 days after the advisory level was previously raised from the lowest interest to caution. This increase in the alert level is a proactive measure, as weather authorities have reported heat wave advisories for 116 of the 235 special weather report zones across the country, anticipating that high temperatures will persist for the foreseeable future. The ministry has therefore instructed heightened monitoring for heat-related illnesses amid concerns that outdoor activities combined with increased humidity following the monsoon season may adversely affect vulnerable populations, including older adults and people who work outdoors, such as farmers.
That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Gian.
Thanks, Andrew.
A new amendment to South Korea's Communications Act, which aims to root out disinformation online, took effect Tuesday. The amended law allows courts to award damages of up to 5 times the proven losses against news organizations and social media influencers that circulate illegal, false, or manipulated information. Additionally, offenders can face fines of up to 1 billion won, or around $654,000. The law, which requires major platforms to set up new response systems, comes amid growing concerns over the flood of falsehoods online. There has also, however, been strong backlash from critics who argue that the definition for false or manipulated information is too vague and that freedom of speech could be threatened. To take a closer look at the revised law, we have two guests joining us on the line. First, we have criminal procedure professor Park Yong-chul from the Seogang University Law School. Hello, Professor Park.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Professor Lee Hee-yeon of Handong International Law School. Hello, Professor Lee.
It's good to be on the program.
Thank you for joining us. For our listeners, Professor Lee, could you give us the details about South Korea's revised Information and Communications Network Act, widely known as the, quote, fake news law? What is it and what does it aim to do?
Right. So this is a law that's already on the books, but it's a revision of an existing rule on formerly called the Act of Promotion of Information and Communication Network Utilization and Information Protection. That's a long, long rule. But here, basically, it basically defines, you know, false information as well as manipulated information, and then deals with it in kind in terms of issuing fines for those folks who, you know, produce that information and spread it online, particularly in the context of, let's say, YouTube or other social media platforms where it reaches a wide audience. Now, here, what we're talking about is situations where not really targeting individuals or, you know, for example, let's say small producers of information and YouTube channels, but we're talking about people who have 100,000 subscribers or more, and maybe also 100,000 plus monthly views in terms of different posts or YouTube views, for instance. So in the event that there is, let's say, false information that's being spread out through these mediums, there can be punitive damages up to 5 times the proven loss that can be given against the let's say, YouTuber or organization that has such information, as well as, let's say, for instance, a fine up to ₩1 billion. And the Korea Media Communications Commission can also impose, you know, additional surcharges on repeat violators. So this is a law that really gets the heart of dealing with this idea of fake news and its spread across Korea.
So does this mean that the government will have access to KakaoTalk chat rooms? Does this apply to posts made by individuals on social media?
Well, thankfully, no. In terms of private KakaoTalk chats, the law's scope doesn't deal with those kinds of situations, because basically the law regulates essentially information that is open to the general public. So naturally, a communication if you're having with a friend, or even in the context of open chats within a KakaoTalk, that doesn't allow for this information to be spread to the general public. So in that sense, simply no, it doesn't apply to Kakao chats, but it may apply to individual social media posts. And that's actually one of the big interesting questions is, mm-hmm. if you have a social media post that's widely, let's say, known, and let's say has, let's say, 100,000 plus monthly views, or in this case, you know, for example, large scale producers of, let's say, social media, then in that situation, there may be the possibility that this may incur the let's say, the law's scope in terms of these kinds of producers. But when it comes to just individuals, in most cases, it will not apply to them.
Mm. So it sounds like in certain cases, posts on Twitter, Substack, Facebook, those kind of platforms might have some legal ramifications. But Professor Park, we have the other concern, of course. Who determines whether information is false or manipulated?
Well, I guess this is one of the key points of the change. The final decision maker would be the court, of course. At the end of the day, it is a pivotal legal decision, and the courts will decide which information will be false or manipulated in order to determine whether usual or punitive damage should be imposed. However, the starting or middle point in making such a decision matters here most. The new law provides that anyone, not just the victims of dissemination of the false or manipulated information, when deeming that the certain information fits in the category, he or she may report the case to the online platform operators like that Professor Lee just talked about. Mm-hmm. Then the operators such as YouTube or others may decide whether such information is either false or manipulated as reported by the complaint. Once such reports are filed to them, the operators may decide which penalty to the uploader of the illegal content is just. Therefore, the operators work as a self-regulator. The penalties are of wide varieties, ranging from stopping the access to the contents, putting restrictions on monetization, including advertising revenue to the suspension or termination of the poster's account. The important middleman is the government, the Korea Media and Communication Commission, the government organization where the chairman is selected by the president. They may provide support to decide which information is false or manipulated by establishing an Information and Communication Service Transparency Center to oversee the operator and to support the activities of fact-checking. Therefore, although the determination of whether any content constitutes false or illegal information appears to be left to the autonomous judgment or platform operators, the regulatory framework is structured in such a way that the government exerts substantial influence over the determination in practice.
Perhaps because of that last point, the law has been harshly criticized from conservative politicians, civic groups, and journalists. One major point of contention is the lack of a clear legal definition of false or manipulated information. Is that correct?
Is the beauty and the ugliness of the law in general. Lots of provisions use very unclear languages to be inclusive, although there is a constitutional principle where the language in every provision has to be defined clearly. Therefore, it would be unfair to only accuse the law that it uses language that is full of unclear or ambiguous meanings. I think the real problem in terms of lack of clarity of the language used in those provisions is those words are just too broad and inclusive. The illegal contents include obscene materials, defamatory contents with intent to harm others' reputations, and discriminatory contents with intent to incite violence, discrimination, hatred of certain people or groups, and on and on. Then what about the manipulated information? Although the intent of harming others' personality rights, property rights, public interest has to be proven, the manipulated information includes false information that is wholly or partially false and falsified information where the contents were altered in a manner that causes others to mistake it for factual information. So the listeners will see what I mean. It is just too complicated and broad. Because of the long list of banned contents to fit the criteria, I believe many people are very uneasy about the broadness of the language, feeling that their freedom of speech is restricted. However, you also need to be mindful that the provisions also specifies that for the purpose of this act, satire and parody shall not be regarded as a manipulated information. The thing is, because of the broadness of language related with manipulated information, chaotic situation may happen. The line between manipulated information and protected opinion or criticism will be often blurred. Different operators or platforms may have different criteria for the same or similar contents or information. Therefore, different penalty or actions will be taken by such private entities.
Perhaps because, again, the complicated and broad nature and the satire and parody clauses that you've mentioned, there are questions naturally about political neutrality and impartiality as well. But Professor Park, since platforms and fact-checking groups are responsible for determining whether information is false or manipulated, and also the organizations receive administrative and financial support from an agency under the Korea Media and Communications Commission, which is a government agency, wouldn't they be affected by the administration in power? And what do you make of this concern?
Well, Korea Media and Communication Commission and the former body of it has been on the public spotlight for a long time due to at least the dispute regarding its political neutrality. Like I said, the head of a commission is personally picked by the president. So naturally, such a structure can never be favorable to silence criticism concerning political neutrality. Also, many contentious information or contents that will be screened by the new provisions that would be more likely about making some accusations about the people in power. Therefore, people may see the provisions as a way to silence the critics against the government. I hope such concerns will turn out to be another false information, but considering the increasing tendency in Korea to interpret and regulate various forms of expressions by different social groups through a political lens, people will have a second thought to be silent to avoid any hassle. Ultimately, it would affect the freedom of speech in a very negative way.
Now let's talk about the journalists, people like myself, who would inevitably be affected and are responding. The revised law has sparked fierce debate over freedom of expression and concerns that its severe penalties could have a chilling effect on the media. The Journalists Association of Korea has said that the mere prospect of news organizations repeatedly facing massive damage claims or legal disputes could have a, quote, unavoidable chilling effect. The association added that, quote, even if a law's objective is legitimate, it could erode the foundations of democracy if it's enforced in a way that discourages the media and ordinary citizens from freely criticizing and scrutinizing those in power. Professor Lee, tell us more about these concerns regarding the freedom of the press.
Right. So as Professor Park alluded to, the issue about interpretation of the text and the law itself with respect to, for example, disinformation, fake news, what's harmful conduct or content, you know, without, let's say, a precise definition, you know, goes to this question about who then will go about interpreting these rules and these statutes with respect to the application of these laws to, let's say, you know, news organizations, YouTubers, people who are very active on social media. And that really, I think, is the big concern, because in the end, of course, this will be potentially be litigated in the courts, and the courts will have to make a decision. But before it gets to the court, there's, you know, a government agency that will decide, right, whether or not this particular content, right, falls under the auspices of the rule. And because there's that issue about the vagueness of the law itself in terms of what these terms mean. So, for example, what is exactly disinformation? What is exactly fake news? The problem is, you know, governments can certainly use that to tighten the screws against critics of the government policy or things that the government doesn't like with respect to what speech it's heard from particular sources, and then apply the pressure of government force to, you know, levy fines and huge fines on YouTubers and against news organizations that, as you mentioned, may have a chilling effect, because these organizations and these individuals will think twice about what they say online. So I think that's really the big question, is how this law will actually be interpreted without specific guidelines. But then, of course, Professor Park also mentioned about, you know, who is being appointed to this commission, this body that will then regulate, you know, the rule and then apply these laws to the public. And so if there's no real independence, right, so the president is the one who's appointing these people, then that's just basically one step removed from the ruling government. And therefore, if it's speech that the government doesn't like, and it's, let's say, heavily critical of the government, and the government then, let's say, if you look at it in the most negative way possible, labels this as fake news, and even though it may be a legitimate criticism, that's when I think a lot of people will be very concerned in terms of how democracy within functions, because the government will then use government force to then penalize people for speech, mm-hmm. right, for saying things which the government doesn't like. So I think that's where the big concern is on that regard. So I think journalists, of course, are very, very concerned about how this will play out.
So I guess it sounds like there could be room for a conflict of interest where the person in charge of the government agency overseeing this has the duty to create this environment where freedom of speech is respected, but then that person is also named by the president, meaning that person could be incentivized to be a little harsher and a little more critical of the criticisms against the government. Professor Park, the conservative main opposition, People Power Party, is, I guess, expectedly up in arms over this law, which it says violates the right to freedom of speech, and of course arguing that the state should not be the one to determine what is true or false. The main opposition party is planning to file a constitutional complaint over the law. What happens to the law if the People Power Party files this constitutional complaint? And how do you think the Constitutional Court will decide on this case? Will it make this annulled, or will it approve this?
Well, I guess the thing is the practical side of this law. The finer say, like Professor Lee said, the finer say on the legality of certain contents should be left to the court. I personally believe that the new law practically takes away such authority from the courts in terms of determining the meaning of manipulate information. And again, the language is just too broad and inclusive. I hope that the intent of a new law was right, avoiding any unfair victimization of any person when some people's only intent is to produce such a content, it's just to make more money. With narrowing the range of banned contents and minimizing the government involvement in terms of rendering decisions on what should be banned with the label of manipulated information, I believe it's more than likely that the Constitutional Court will make a very unfavorable decision on the current provisions.
We're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to be talking about AI, the biggest technology of our generation. With the rise of generative AI, it's now easier than ever to create misleading content such as deceptive images and videos. Professor Lee, how are countries throughout the world addressing this problem in the age of AI?
Right. So countries and jurisdictions are taking different approaches. And so the most comprehensive, I guess, approach would be the European Union. And the European Union has established something called an AI Act. And in that situation, in that law, deepfakes and AI-generated text with respect to matters of public interest, they have to be clearly and visibly labeled. So the point here is there has to be no intent to deceive the public. So even if, let's say, someone puts out this AI-generated material or images, if the content looks or sounds like a real person, there has to be disclosure that this is AI generated. So there's a set of rules and regulations the EU has established, and really steep fines too, like up to 35 million euros.
Wow.
Or like 7% of global annual turnover for really serious violations. So yeah, I mean, in terms of the EU, they've really gone all in terms of really addressing this problem on a very, very high level. Now, in terms of the United States, however, the United States, particularly with the Trump administration in power, really is focused on deregulation at the federal level, but certainly at the state level, each state can have its own regulations and rules. So there is a federal framework for dealing with, let's say, AI-generated material. Because the Trump administration's approach generally to these kinds of matters is deregulation, there's not really a strong sort of federal rule on these kinds of issues. But the states are doing basically most of the work. So 46 mm-hmm. states in the U.S. have some AI related law and that deal with these kinds of issues and deep fakes particularly. But other countries around the world, like in our part of the world, like China, as you can imagine, would have a very strict regime for dealing with deep fakes and AI materials as well. But interestingly, Japan, in comparison, has like maybe the lightest touch approach. In that sense, there's really really encouraging cooperation and public naming of violators, but as I looked at it, no monetary penalties at all at this point. That may change later, but in any event, I think the approaches that you see around the world are various.
Mm. We're going to be continuing to talk about this issue on a global scale because generative AI naturally leads to the question, again, the focus topic of today, fake news and online disinformation, which have become, again, a pressing social issue around the world. It's something that authorities around the world are keeping a close eye on, as Professor Lee just discussed. As a legal expert, Professor Lee, we're going to go to you first, and then we're going to ask Professor Park. But Professor Lee, what changes would you recommend to improve fake news laws around the world?
Right. I mean, that's really, it's hard because, you know, fake news obviously is a problem, but, you know, there's the balance here with free speech and to hold governments accountable. And so, I mean, I struggle with this quite a bit because part of the approach could be, you know, with respect to regulation, there's an interest to protect the public and the government has that right. But at the same time, you know, this idea that, you know, you could regulate, let's say, fake news with, you know, more news or, you know, this sort of public airing of more ideas and let the public decide, right? And so in terms of dealing with the law itself, I think, you know, since we do have a law in Korea and that's not going to change anytime soon, I would like to see more specificity. I know, I mean, the law is written in such a way and this is how legislation is made with some vagueness so that there can be room for interpretation. But I think that's where we'll have to see as the law is actually applied and we'll see how this actually turns up and civic groups and other organizations see how the government then actually applies it. I think this is where, you know, we'll have to watch very carefully in terms of how this government agency will apply the rule. And so if it's such a situation where only, let's say, enemies of the government or enemies of the ruling party or critics of the government are really the ones being targeted, I think then you'll see, I think, hopefully more calls for some changes. But I think we're at the point where we're going to have to wait and see because really the devil's in the details. And so as a result, we're going to see whether or not the government actually applies it in a fair and even-handed way. And I think this is where the media, this is where NGOs, civic groups will have to really carefully watch how the government applies this and then see what the effects are in the medium and long term.
Mm. Professor Park, what are your thoughts regarding this dilemma that Professor Lee just mentioned, this balance, this very delicate balancing act between regulating fake news and then also the need to respect the freedom of speech?
I guess if you think the freedom of speech is more important, obviously regulating fake news, you know, there has to be room for that. But, I think one thing that all the politicians have to do is they have to be away from, they have to make an effort to be away from the fake news. Given the heavy influence that people in power may give to the public, they should be more than extra careful not to disseminate any false information. But sadly, I think the reality is exactly the opposite. Mm. We have witnessed, for the past 10 years or so that, you know, politicians talk about fake news. And since also there's a consumer on 24/7 cycle of fake news tends to be replaced by another fake news, making people very numb about the source. The contents of fake news will not be left in front of a public eye and the impact of it would remain. Therefore, any government should not be the decision maker when it comes to the definition of fake news. Give the role to the court and they are responsible for making any legal decisions. And I believe the better way of improving the fake news law will be returning to the right, to the court. So they will have a say on the issue.
This is a very complicated and important issue. That is why we were talking about this in our in-depth news analysis segment today. That was Professor Park Yong-chul from the Seogang University Law School. Thank you, Professor Park.
Thank you.
And we also had Professor Lee Hee-yun of Handong International Law School. Thank you, Professor Lee.
It was my pleasure.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. the benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 184.03 points, or 2.52%, on Friday to close at 7,475.94. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 43.43 points, or 5.47%, to close at 837.43. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and hand-picked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
What's our first story?
K-pop mega band BTS has been hit with a plagiarism lawsuit in the United States over their song Swim.
Can you give us more details about this lawsuit, please?
Sure. Billboard reported Thursday that songwriters Steve Cooper, John Sandler, and Graylin Johnson filed a lawsuit the previous day alleging that BTS's Swim is substantially similar to a demo song of the same title that they had written. The case is expected to proceed through the U.S. legal system, where the court will determine whether the similarities alleged by the plaintiffs constitute copyright infringement.
And who specifically is being targeted? Is it the BTS members, their label or agency, or is it the people being credited with actually writing and producing the songs?
Well, according to the report, the complaints names HYBE, HYBE America, Big Hit Music, and several songwriters credited on Swim, including Ryan Tedder, the frontman of American pop rock band One Republic. While BTS leader RM is also credited as one of the songwriters, the plaintiffs did not name any of the BTS members as defendants in this lawsuit.
What has BTS and their agency said about this?
On Friday, in an interview with a local media outlet, Big Hit Music firmly rejected the allegations and maintained that Swim is an independent original work. The Korean firm pointed out that the lawsuit contains only the plaintiff's unilateral claims. Big Hit vowed to fight the case in court, saying it will respond firmly through the legal process.
I guess we'll have to wait for the facts to present themselves in court, but let's move on to our next story.
Smart glasses equipped with artificial intelligence technology are gadgets many tech early adopters are eager to get their hands on. But unfortunately for the manufacturers and aspiring users, the gadget has been getting a bad reputation recently.
We've, of course, talked about this theme on Korea Trending before, AI glasses being misused, one instance to cheat on exams. Sounds like you're going to be talking about something along those lines today.
Well, Seoul Gangseo Police Station said Thursday that a man is under investigation over allegations of using AI smart glasses to secretly film women he dated and share the footage online via social media. He claims he did it to preserve memories. Police are investigating whether the footage includes intimate images of the women and are reviewing whether additional charges related to sex crimes should apply. It's not just Korea. There have been major cases involving AI glasses being misused for exam cheating or covert filming reported in various countries, including China and Spain.
Sounds like a very scary story that you have today, Dan. But what are some of the most concerning aspects of AI glasses that were highlighted in this case?
They're deceptively normal. They blend in. The glasses are designed not to stick out, but rather appear regular and even fashionable through collaboration with popular brands. So unless specifically explaining that these are AI glasses with cameras, no one will suspect they are such devices. Most are equipped with recording indicator light that should indicate photos are being taken or video recordings are being made with the glasses. But in some models, it is not too difficult to just cover the light up with tape.
So obviously, room for this new tech to be misused, as in all new techs. But what about the companies behind the gadgets? Are they taking measures, making upgrades, or ensuring the devices aren't misused?
Well, some manufacturers claim they've been implementing measures to prevent the misuse of AI glasses. For the LED indicator light, it is designed in a way that if a black sticker is used to cover it, the camera cannot be activated. Some models have built-in speaker emitting shutter sound when a photo or video is taken. Major firms, including Meta, said they are continuously seeking ways to make the devices safer and more reliable.
AI glasses, lots of potential, but also lots of room for misuse. But now to our final story. What do you have, Dan?
Ko Woo-suk has made his Major League Baseball debut. Didn't happen overnight. He stuck to his guns and continued to put in the work for nearly 3 years to get there.
To stand on the mound in the big leagues must have been a special moment, obviously, for Ko Woo-suk. But how was his performance?
Not that great, unfortunately. His Minnesota Twins fell 5-2 to the Cleveland Guardians at Target Field on Thursday local time. Taking the mound to begin the top of the ninth with the Twins trailing 4-2, Guo fired off a grounder to send a batter packing for the first time, but then gave up a solo home run. Down the stretch, though, the Twins failed to rally and came up short.
So not the best of debuts, but then not too bad either. But many fans are likely aware that Ko Woo-suk has been through a lot, like many others who've reached the big leagues after years of struggles in the minors. Dan, tell us his story.
Lots of jersey switching going on there. Go left the LG Twins of the Korea Baseball Organization to sign with the San Diego Padres in January 2024 after leading the South Korean League with 139 saves from 2019 to 2023. He was dealt to the Miami Marlins in May 2024. Marlins released him in June 2025. Detroit Tigers acquired him. He became a free agent and then rejoined the Tigers in another minor league deal in December, rejected a lucrative offer from Korea's LG Twins to come back home and play so he could keep pursuing his MLB dream. He joined the Twins via a trade by the Tigers earlier in the week, and here we are.
Ko Woo-suk is, of course, not the first Korean player to reach the big leagues. How many other Koreans have been to the MLB?
Wearing number one on his jersey, Ko became the 30th South Korean to appear in an MLB game. Ko and his brother-in-law, San Francisco Giants outfielder Lee Jong-hoo, are currently the only two active South Korean players in the major league, as in there are other players honing their games in the AAA or the minor league. At the moment, the Minnesota Twins are looking to shore up their bullpen as they are dead last among 30 MLB clubs. So expectations are high that Ko could be their next go-to guy.
The best of luck to Ko Woo-suk, but that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time now for our Friday segment, Movie Spotlight, where we debate box office hits as well as the must-watch indie picks. Joining us in the studio again are our movie critics, Jason Beshervace. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
And Darcy Paquette. Hello, Darcy.
Hi, Andrew.
Jason, your choice this week is Hana Korea, which is an international co-production between Denmark and South Korea. Tell us about the movie.
Yeah, sure. So this film is directed by Danish filmmaker Fredrik Solberg. It stars the Korean actress Kim Min-hye as a North Korean defector. She's just arrived in South Korea, it stands in strong contrast to North Korea, where she's from. You know, we know that South is modern, it's advanced, it's fast-paced, it's wealthy, and, you know, it can be overwhelming for North Korean defectors. And we see her kind of reflecting on her past and struggling, like leaving her past behind, whilst also feeling like she has to embrace her new world, right? She's made that decision. And the story is inspired by in-depth interviews with around 30 North Korean defectors at a training facility in a suburb of south of Seoul called Hanawon. And there the filmmaker met a defector that the story inspired the film, and the director's kind of initial idea for the title, actually, it came from being in a restaurant, a Korean restaurant, I think in 2010, and he met like two men, and one of them said his wish was to have Hana, as in one, mm-hmm. one Korea. And so that's where the title is sourced from, Hana Korea. And the film was co-written by Sharon Che, Bong Joon-ho's famous translator. Mm-hmm. And it also stars Kim Ji-rong and An So-yeon from Okja. So there's another, Bong Joon-ho connection there. Mm-hmm. In premiere, I saw it at the Busan Film Festival. And it's screened at other festivals, including Toronto and Gothenburg.
For listeners who might be wondering, Jason has had a long week, so his voice is a little down. But Jason, there's been several films about the plights of North Korean defectors, like The Journals of Musan. And how does Hana Korea compare to those?
It's It's interesting. I think in many respects it kind of follows that trajectory, you know, of this kind of North Korean de facto adjusting to life, you know, in the South. And it is like really, really testing. And, you know, some defectors go back to or want to go back to North Korea because it's so difficult. And yeah. And so in that sense, it does feel like a familiar story and it's told in a familiar way. That being said, it's just so well, you know, it is a highly accomplished film. It, you know, the performances are fantastic. It feels really authentic. It feels like it's well written. And, you know, Sharon Choi, obviously she's South Korean. You've got a non-Korean filmmaker at the helm. And so sometimes there is a danger that it feels disconnected. But actually that's not true here. It does feel like a Korean film, but at the same time, I think it's made in a way that it's accessible for international audiences, you know. I have had a long week and my voice is kind of going because I've been teaching so much. I've been teaching various classes, and one film I do talk about is Reach for the Sky, which is a South Korean Belgian international co-production, and that film has a Belgian filmmaker and a Korean filmmaker behind it. And there's just a slightly different sensibility at like approaching, you know, these subjects, be it, you know, in the case of Reach for the Sky's education, in the case of obviously Hannah Korea is North Korean defector. And so it's made, yes, it feels Korean, but it's also, it feels accessible for, to it, you know, for an international audience. And so as a result, it doesn't, it has screened at festivals. I mean, it's screened at the Toronto Film Festival, which was a great, great achievement, and others too. So, I do like it. There's nothing in terms of like, how is it different? How would you differentiate it from other Korean films or Korean films that deal with defectors? I don't think it scores 10 out of 10 for that, but you know, still it's a well-made film all the same.
You've kind of talked about this already, but does the touch from the Korean writers and producers, does that help out? And is it unusual for a non-Korean director to make a Korean language film?
It is. We don't see that many of them, although I think we're going to see more over the next, you know, few years, because, you know, Korea is obviously a popular place to come to. And we're seeing a lot more. I personally seeing a lot more kind of non-Korean filmmakers or aspiring filmmakers wanting to make work here, and it's not easy to get those opportunities. And so the fact that he got this made, you know, is an achievement in itself. And so, yes, I do think we'll see more of it. I think the teaming is crucial here. You've got a Korean writer, and a very good one, very well versed in Korean, you know, the Korean film industry, and also the themes that this film tackles. But you've got this Danish filmmaker as well, which brings a different sensibility to it. So I think it was a good team. You know, I don't know about how difficult it was, you know, or how well it works behind the scenes, but you know, and I'm very happy with the result.
Darcy, would you agree?
Yes, I like the film. I think that it, you know, you don't really feel any particular agenda with the film. It did feel somewhat balanced, and its focus seems primarily just in putting us inside the head of this character, who is kind of carrying a lot with her to Korea. Like, she has guilt about leaving her mother behind. She is carrying some trauma from her experiences, you know, on the way to South Korea as well. But you know, the film shows us the process of gradually adjusting to South Korea. And so I think we feel this sense of intimacy with the character as we're watching it.
For sure. We're going to move on to our next film. Darcy, your pick this week is a bit late coming to Korea. The Brazilian film, The Secret Agent, was one of the most talked about films of last year and was a strong contender at the Oscars. It finally opened for the Korean audience this Wednesday. And again, before we discuss the film, why is it that some big international films come to Korea quite quickly and then some others come a little later?
Yeah, I mean, partly it depends on which company is distributing it. So if it's a big Hollywood studio that's, you know, distributing the latest Marvel film, then it tends to be kind of coordinated worldwide, the release. But, you know, a movie like this, it tends to be picked up by a Korean importer, you know, at festivals like Cannes. And then it's a real struggle to kind of, you know, get a release date in the calendar. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them try to coincide with the Oscars, you know, if they think the film has some Oscar potential. And this was one of the films that a lot of people were talking about, you know, in February and March. But it seems that they weren't able to get a slot in that time period. And so, so yeah, we're getting it a bit late, but better late than never.
Yeah, better late than never.
Returning to the film, who are the people behind the film and why did it create such an impression?
Okay, so the director is Kleber Mendonça Filho, who made a couple films that were quite, you know, well praised in the past, Aquarius, Baccarat. And, you know, this film, in particular, the leading actor, Wagner Mara, who mm-hmm. appears in the film in Narcos, is, you know, he received a lot of praise for his performance in this film. It's set in 1977 Brazil. It gives a viewer a real sense of what it's like to kind of live within the midst of a brutal military dictatorship. But the film stands out for great acting. There are a lot of interesting characters in the film. And then interesting storytelling, like not what you expect in terms of the way that it's presented to the audience. Premiered at Cannes last year, where it won Best Director and Best Actor. Mm-hmm. And then since then, it's just been winning various awards, although it didn't win an Oscar.
Tell us more about the plot and the story itself.
So it's centered around the main character. He, you know, he arrives in this town where he's originally from after spending, you know, some time away from it. And one of the strengths of the film is that it doesn't really give you too much information at the beginning. So I'll try not to fill in too much. But, you know, he moves into this home at the beginning of the film that it seems to be some kind of a shelter. Mm-hmm. They call themselves refugees, although they're not refugees from other countries. You know, they seem to be people who've upset the government or other powerful people in some way. There's a woman in her 70s who owns this home and has opened up her home to these people, and she's quite an interesting character. The main character has a young son whom he misses terribly, but, you know, he can't live with him for the son's own protection. And, you know, we follow him as gradually we kind of learn more about his situation, but we also occasionally cut to some people in the present who are listening to these taped conversations with the main character in 1977. And so they're trying to piece together what happened to him as well.
So it sounds like there's a lot of mystery in the plot. But what did you think of the film? Did the secret agent live up to its reputation?
It really did. You know, it's filled with so many interesting characters and great actors, so you can simply watch the film for its performances. Mm. But I was really struck with the storytelling as well, because, you know, in a movie like this, which is kind of trying to expose the brutality of an authoritarian military dictatorship, you kind of brace yourself, you know, for the just, you know, these terrible scenes that are just going to kind of ravage you. That's not the approach that the film takes. You know, it kind of pulls back at some moments and it presents it from an unusual perspective. And yet, despite that, it doesn't come across as any less mm-hmm. effective for that reason. And so again, I don't want to say too much about the film because, you know, it's best if you just kind of discover it as you're watching it. But, you know, in terms of acting and storytelling, and it really, again, gives you a vivid sense of life in Brazil in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, both the energy of that era, like it's a beautifully presented film, and at the same time, quite frightening as well.
Sounds like both films have this heaviness kind of looming over it.
Yep.
But it was this week's movie Spotlight. We had Hana Korea from Jason Bechervais and The Secret Agent from Darcy Paquette. Thank you two.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back on Monday. A reminder to our listeners that Korea 24 is produced by an all-star team, starting with our fantastic editor, Daria Kim, our very calm and patient producer, Yoon So-hyang, and our veteran leader, Kim Bum-soo. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.